If you do an internet search for the Ten Commandments, one of the interesting things that pops up is the alternative to the Ten Commandments. There are atheists, secular humanists, scientists, even some Christians who have come up with a better Ten Commandments. A number of years ago, they did a survey. If there was a new Ten Commandments, who should write them? And the number one person chosen in this survey of thousands of people was Oprah Winfrey. Because she could write a better Ten Commandments. So we live in this world in which more and more the Ten Commandments are seen as basically ancient laws given by a mythical god that have nothing to do with the world in which we live in. Well, of course, we started here a couple of weeks ago a series of sermons on the Ten Commandments. And we went through the first commandment, which is, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. And we went through and showed that that is the basis of all the commandments. God claims, I am the God of Israel. So the God of this book claims that he is the God and that he has the right to declare what is right and wrong, what is good and evil. And the Ten Commandments actually aren't just for the people of Israel. They're for all humanity, all mankind, because he is the God of all humanity. Now, there is a response, as we went through, that we're supposed to have. If we actually understand that commandment, there is a human response. The human response is belief that he is God. It also involves loyalty, trust, and obedience. So we went through the enormity of that simple command and what it actually means as we broke it down. Well, today we're going to talk about the second commandment. The second commandment actually involves how God then requires that he be respected and worshipped. He's declared himself in the first commandment, I am the God, and you must respond to me, and you must be loyal to me, and you must trust me, and you must obey me. But the second command is all about how he says, I will be worshipped. Now, if you believe the first command, then you realize he has the right to demand that. It was interesting as I went through various people's Ten Commandments, from Stephen Hawking everybody's come up with the new Ten Commandments. And one writer who had come up with new Ten Commandments said that this was just so arrogant for this being to claim that he had to be worshipped. So he said the first four have to be thrown out entirely because they're just an expression of arrogance. And I thought, wow, someday he's going to appear before this God. That should be an interesting meeting. So let's look at that second commandment, Exodus 20. Because we don't only have to look at what it meant to ancient Israel, which we will, but what it should mean to us. Because this is an easy commandment for us to sort of ignore because, well, we're not involved in this. We don't see a lot of this, we think. So we just sort of, we know what that commandment is. But no, we can break this commandment too, especially in the spirit of the law. Exodus 20, verse 4. You shall not make for yourselves a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them. Now I'm going to stop there, because we'll come back to the rest of this commandment in a few minutes. You're not to make yourselves a carved image. Now some people have taken this to an extent that said, well, you shouldn't even take a photograph of anybody. You shouldn't even have a picture. No, the point here is this point where it says, you shall not bow down to them nor serve them. This has to do with worship. And it says, bow down and serve. Those are two very, very important, especially in Hebrew. Those are very important statements. So why is it that God said we shouldn't do this? Okay, you can't make anything and use it in the aid of worship to him. Well, there's a couple of reasons. Now, let's look at a couple of reasons. Then we'll expand it out into how we can break this law and not even know it. The first reason why God says not to do this is because God forbids the use of idols in the worship of him because of his uniqueness. Let me show you something. Let's go to Deuteronomy 4. His uniqueness. We have a real problem when we understand how God has revealed himself and that we're going to try to make something that will symbolize God. You know, I've been to the Sistine Chapel. How many of you have been to the Sistine Chapel? Okay, how many of you have seen pictures of the Sistine Chapel? You know, the center point of the Sistine Chapel, and the painting on the roof is God touching the hand, the finger of Adam. It's real dramatic. It is a dramatic painting. Until you realize, so that's what God is. Sort of a old-looking, heavy-set, wrinkled guy. Is that how God wants us to think about him when we pray? Sort of this old, wrinkled, heavy-set guy. Not too bad. Well, he's just sort of muscular, you know, but he's reaching out and touching Adam. Is that how we're supposed to see God? How do you represent God when you understand the greatness of God? And this is the first reason why idolatry is a major issue with God. You know, it's easy for us in our tolerant society to say, well, this shouldn't be a big thing. Come on. So what? Well, you know, a picture of what God is supposed to be, or a little statue. Come on, what does that hurt? It helps us be able to visualize God. Let's look at what he told the ancient Israelites. And this is in Deuteronomy 4, verse 11. And he's talking about when he gave them the Ten Commandments. So this is in the context of, remember when I gave you the Ten Commandments? Remember what it was like to be beneath that mountain? Remember, we talked about it last night. We talked about how it was shaking and it was fire. And there was a being on top of that mountain that was terrifying. When they heard his voice, they said to Moses, you go talk to him because he's going to kill us. His very presence was overwhelming. Let's pick it up in verse 11. So we're in the middle of this, what he's talking about here, reminding them of what it was like to be before Mount Sinai. Then you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain. The mountain burned with fire in the midst of heaven, and darkness and cloud and thick darkness. He says, remember what that was like? These boiling clouds of darkness coming off this mountain, and this thunder and this fire, and how it was frightening to be in the presence of God. And the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of the words, but saw no form. You only heard a voice. So he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, the Ten Commandments, and he wrote them on two tablets of stone. And the Lord commanded me at that time, this is Moses writing, to teach you statutes and judgments, that you might observe them in the land which you cross over to possess. Take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire. Lest you act corruptly and make for yourselves a carved image in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any animal that is on the earth, or the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, or the likeness of any fish that is in the water beneath the earth. Take heed, lest you lift up your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun, the moon, and the stars, all the hosts of heaven, you feel driven to worship them and serve them. Now, this is the same idea. We're going to create a representation of God so that we may worship it, which the Lord your God has given to all the peoples under the whole heaven as a heritage. Now, that's also a very important little comment there we can miss. Okay, so God says, don't worship the sun and moon and stars to these ancient Israelites because, you know, I've given those to you. That's not what he says. I've given this to everyone. This is universal. This is why the Ten Commandments are universal. Because God reveals himself in very simple terms. I mean, Christianity, becoming Christ-like is a whole lot more than just keeping the Ten Commandments. But you got to start someplace. You got to have a foundation to build off of, and that's where we start with the Ten Commandments. And so he says here, don't do this. Remember, God didn't let you see him. You couldn't have handled it anyways. To see God as he is something that we as human beings could not live and see. In fact, isn't that what Moses was told? You can't look on me. It'll kill you. Your mind cannot take seeing God in reality. So we're going to create a little thing that sort of looks like it. So the first reason is we're not allowed to try to make representation of God because he says, I'm bigger than anything you create, which is just made out of something I created. And it has to do with worship. You know, in English, when we use the word worship, what do we usually think of as a synonym? Praise, right? Praise and worship. We sing. We show thanks to God. You know, the Hebrew word for worship and praise are two totally different words. They're not related at all. Worship in Hebrew literally means to bow down. It means to get on your face, prostrate before something or someone. This is what happened when kings would walk down the street to the ancient world. Everybody would fall on their face because if you didn't, you would die. It has to do with total subjection. Worship, the concept of worship in the Old Testament is total, complete subjection. You're on your face. So we're talking about the worship of God. And that's why in the commandment he says what? Bow down and serve. Who do we bow down to and who do we serve? That is the real meaning of the second commandment. Who do we serve? Who are we accepting as master? Who do we bow down to? So this is why he said, you're not even to make an image of me, God said. Because we are to bow down to God in his realizing that he is greater than anything we can imagine. The prophets talk about this. I mean, it's fascinating to go through the prophets, whether it's the major prophets or the minor prophets, and see what they say about idolatry. In fact, if you look at Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the minor prophets, you will see that the number one thing that God condemns ancient Israel and ancient Judah for is idolatry. Over and over and over again. There's a place in Isaiah 40 where God inspires Isaiah to write, to whom will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare him to? In other words, the point is, how do you think you know what I am like? Now, we know we're made in the image of God. But God says, okay, only take that so far. Because I'm greater than that. So, God is very specific that how do we take the creator of the universe, who has all power, the God that knows all your thoughts, and my thoughts. Now think about that. All of us. At the same time. They can't even create a computer even remotely that powerful. How does he process everything at the same time? Everybody, no matter what they are, no matter what language they speak, no matter, he understands, he knows, he hears. How does the all-powerful, all-ever-present God, what do we make him look like? And this is why idolatry is so serious if we try to make an image of God. Because idolatry degrades the spiritual and awe-inspiring nature of God. It actually degrades it. Idolatry, an attempt to make even the God of the Bible into an image, is degrading to who he actually is. Look at John 4, because here we have in John 4, really, the essence of the second commandment in the New Testament. John 4, two verses that probably everybody here knows by heart. But it is the essence. Here is the new covenant explanation of the second commandment. This is what the second commandment leads us to. John 4, verse 23, Jesus Christ said, but the hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father. Now, this isn't exactly the same word because it's in Greek, but the same concept. Worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. And here's why. God is spirit. And those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. to lower God down to a physical thing that we bow down to represent Him, is to degrade His nature. It is to degrade who He is. And He takes it very serious. And that's why I find it interesting when I read the one article where the guy said, how arrogant, you know, how arrogant for this being to say, oh, you can't make images of me. Wow. How arrogant do you think that they even come up with that concept? So, we understand that idolatry degrades the nature of God. So then we take the second step. The second reason why is really so obvious also, is that when you make idols of gods that don't exist, it's a lie. It's a falsehood. Those gods do not exist. And that's why throughout the Old Testament, you'll find in some of the prophets a sarcasm about idolatry that is just overwhelming. A sarcasm because that's a piece of rock you're worshiping. Oh, no, no, this represents my God. No, it doesn't. He doesn't exist. So that's a piece of stone. And so there's this ridicule of people who are believing that somehow this idol, and you know, when people worship idols, they don't say that is the God. They say that represents the God or the goddess and therefore possesses special powers. The idol itself possesses special powers. It's very interesting how during the end of the Roman Empire, many of the temples, people would go in and witness amazing, what they would consider amazing miracles. And they're recorded how people would go into these pagan temples and witness all these amazing miracles, and the gods would talk to them, and they would get answers. Well, they've discovered something. They've discovered actual sort of blueprint plans for some of the temples. And the idols were machines. Some of them literally had holes in them, and priests down below the idol so they could hear the person's prayer. And then a little tube that came up to the mouth of the idol, and the priest would speak in answer to the person. And some of them would move. Well, there's some guy cranking. You know, he's down below cranking it, and it's moving. And it made people believe there's real power in that. See, people believe the idols contain power. At the core of idolatry is superstition and magic. There is magic in the object. The object itself is magical because the god or the goddess works through the object. Look at Psalm. Let's go to Psalm 115. Because here David writes about idolatry. Psalm 115, verse 3. God wants us to worship in spirit and truth. The spirit of idolatry is the spirit of superstition and magic. And we're going to see in a little bit, it's even worse than that. Psalm 115, verse 3. But our God is in heaven. Our God is in another realm. We don't see our God, but we believe in our God. He does whatever He pleases. Now that's a very interesting statement that David makes here. Our God is not bound by physical laws. Our God does what He pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they do not speak. Eyes they have, but they do not see. They have ears, but they do not hear. Noses they have, they do not smell. They have hands, but they do not handle. Feet they have, but they do not walk. Nor do they mutter through their throat. Those who make them are like them, and so is everyone who trusts in them. He says people who make idols and worship idols are blind and deaf and dead. That's quite a spiritual statement. And you need that spiritually. Now, people who worship idols are spiritually blind and deaf and dead. This leads us to something that, well, before I go there, let me bring out another point here. Why would people then be attracted to idolatry? Because idolatry is the core of all non-Christian or non-Jewish religion since the first religions. Why is it? Well, idolatry appeals to human beings for a number of reasons. The first is, we are designed to have a need for a spiritual connection to God. You and I are designed to have that. Now, if you don't have a spiritual connection to God, you still, we almost inherently believe there is another world out there. There's something that we're supposed to interact with. That spiritual need drives us. If we don't know the real God, we'll make up a God. We need God. So human beings cut off from God will make up gods. It's what they do because they are driven to. Because we want more than this life. And so there's an attempt to fulfill this spiritual connection. But that's why idolatry is so filled with mysticism and secret knowledge and superstition. And it's all about feeling. It's all about feeling. Because they're trying to fulfill a spiritual need. It is also an attempt to answer the unknown questions of nature. How do we make sure the rains come every year? You know, you and I understand the science of things that for most of humanity, they didn't understand the science of it. The ancient Egyptians actually believed that Pharaoh went to the sun god every year and caused the Nile River to flood so that it would deposit silt onto their fields so that they could grow crops. They believed it. Something had to do it. So they believe that everything has an intelligence to it. Something has to do it. That's why people believe in astrology. The stars are wandering around telling you how to live. Where did that come from? Ancient people believed that those were beings. That those, the stars and the planets, were beings. And when scientists, the earliest scientists, astrologers begin, or astronomers, begin to look at it and say, wait a minute, these things move in patterns. They said, see, it proves they are living beings. Because only living beings would move in patterns. So if we know when we were born, we'll know what the stars were like then, and we'll be able to figure out, they'll tell us how you're supposed to live. And you know, there's still people today. But get out, get the newspaper or go online and read their horoscope every day. Why? Because those beings will tell me how to live. Now, that's not what they say, but that's where it came from. That's where it came from. Those living beings will tell me how to live. That's all part of idolatry. That's why he said, don't even look at the stars and try to make images out of that. But there's that need. Nature, we have to explain nature. So you worship nature. The nature must, Mother Earth, which many New Agers today believe actually is a goddess, Mother Earth is a concept. The earth must be alive. It produces life. Explain how you put a seed in the ground and it grows 3 months later. Explain that. Even with our science, we can't explain entirely how life is working. There's gaps in how they understand that. Well, if you lived 3,000 years ago, how do you explain it? There's some God making that happen. And if we make an idol to that God, he'll help us. And there'll be magic in the idol. It's interesting that when it comes to love, and almost all, not all, but most pagan religions, it was a woman. It was a goddess. So they would go to the goddess, and she would give them love. They used to go to the gods, they didn't care much about it, but the goddesses did. So you begin to understand their need to fulfill a spiritual void. And that's what idolatry is. Now also, many times, idolatry really unleashed sexual freedom. One of the most amazing things about almost all pagan religions is the amount of sexual freedom that they allow, or they even promote. Of course, the most obvious when we think about in the ancient times is at Ephesus and at Corinth, where they both had temple prostitutes. And everybody went to temple prostitutes, men and women. There were temple prostitutes in ancient Babylon. In fact, in ancient, there was one point in Babylon's history where every woman, and I can't remember which god it was, as a sacrifice of that god, had to go sell herself at the temple as a prostitute for at least once in her life. And women went to do it, so they'd wait till they were older, and the men would come up and buy the younger women. This is a description that we actually have from Herodotus, who was a Greek who traveled to Babylon. About 400s B.C. He said, so the older women would sit there for days because you couldn't leave until you were chosen. And men would bid till they were able to get her for practically nothing. So they learned to sell themselves young. Sexual immorality was really unleashed in so much of idolatry. And also, it really is an attempt to control power. It is interesting that in how many idolatrous religions, if you do the right ritual before the statue, say the right words, do the right dance, the god has to do what you want. If I do the right rain dance, the god of rain will give me rain. He has to. I did the dance. So there is an attempt to control what they cannot control. So idolatry reaches into the very core of human needs. It is incredibly emotional. Incredibly emotional. An attempt to explain what is unexplainable. An attempt to tap into a spiritual need that they have. Now, I would dare say that none of you have altars to Zeus in your basement. You're not out worshiping gods and goddesses, right? But how can we break this commandment and not even know it? Well, let's go back and let's look through what we've talked about. Let's bring out some points. How do people actually break this commandment today? Well, the first one's still obvious, is the use of any image that is used to represent God is unacceptable to God. Now, what I'm going to say next is not politically correct. But we have to understand it's what the Bible teaches. This would mean that Hinduism, Buddhism, most of the religions throughout much of the world are not simply different ways to get to the same God. That's becoming very popular in our society. All religions are just a different ways to get to the same God. They are not. And if you and I begin to go down that path, we are beginning to become idolatrous. Because we're accepting idolatry as a path to God. So we have to be very careful about that concept. They are not acceptable to God. I want you to look at, sometimes we don't look at God's emotional reaction to things. Now, fortunately, his emotions are under control. His emotions are, I think it was read in the sermonette. God's anger doesn't last very long. Aren't you glad? Because it's always under control. But he does express his emotions. Now, they're not like ours in that they're not chemically based, so I can't imagine God's emotions. They must be much more real than ours. Well, let's go to Deuteronomy 7. I want you to look at some instructions here to ancient Israel, and then I want you to look at how he told them to respond. Deuteronomy 7. Now, this is the Old Covenant. How much more should we respond to this if we have God's Spirit. Because God's Spirit was not poured out upon those people as it is in the church. Deuteronomy 7:25. He's talking about when they go into areas of Canaan and they have idols there. He says, you're going to go into places and there's going to be temples with idols. When you go into those temples, here's what you must do. You shall burn the carved images of their gods with fire. You shall not covet the silver or gold that is on them. In other words, he says, you just melt down and destroy the gold, the silver, the precious stones. Because people put a lot, they would put a lot of wealth into the creation of these temples and into the creation of these idols. He said, you destroy it. You don't save part of it. You don't cut it up. You destroy all of it. You shall not covet the silver or gold that is on them, nor take it for yourselves, lest you be snared by it, for it is an abomination to the Lord your God. The word abomination in Hebrew is incredibly powerful. It means to loathe something. It means detestable. I guess to put it in English, it's something that makes you absolutely sick. You hate it. It is a powerful word. Well, it means something that God loathes, something God detests. He says, I detest when my created children make little statues, with a human body and a bird head, I'm thinking one of the Egyptian gods, and say, oh, I'll go worship this. He says, I loathe that. I hate that. God's emotions here, he's expressing them. He's telling them, this isn't just because I'm saying, oh, don't do that, but it's okay. This is absolutely detestable to God. Because he says, how do I have a relationship with you when you're doing that? How can you relate to me when you're relating to Baal? I have to show you a picture. I did a sermon one time on Baal. I have to show you a picture of Baal. It is really, the storm god is about a wimpy little thing as you'd ever see. It's really, you think a storm god would be a little bit more powerful than that. I mean, they actually have statues of Baal they've dug up. So, he says, how can you relate to me? He says, how can we have a relationship if that's how you see gods? And ignore him as the God. But notice then, verse 26. Nor shall you bring an abomination into your house. He says, you can't, don't bring statues into your house. Lest you be doomed to destruction like it. You shall utterly detest it and utterly abhor it, for it is an accursed thing. We can become so complacent with idolatry that we do not abhor it. And it's an interesting command. Those people were told, this should make you as disgusting as it makes me. Or as disgusted as it makes me. This should make you as disgusted as it makes me. That's God's instruction to them. Think about Paul. Paul's an interesting man because Paul was born into the Greek world, but he's a Jew. He's what we would call an Orthodox Jew, born into a Greek world, interacted with both the Greek world and the Jewish world. What was it like for him to walk through Athens? Athens was the center of the intellectual center of the world. It was the philosophical center of the world. And every religion you can imagine was there. See, we don't realize what happened with the Roman Empire is that they took religions and mixed them all up. You could worship anything you wanted. It didn't matter. I was surprised when we went to Pompeii that one of the buildings that survived is this wee little temple. Not to the Roman gods, but to Isis, the Egyptian gods. And there were people in Pompeii that went regularly to the little temple of Isis and worshipped her. So Paul now goes to Athens and he sees all this idolatry, and look what it did to him. Acts 17, verse 16. Now, while Paul waited for them at Athens, His spirit was provoked within him when he saw that the city was given over to idols. It overwhelmed him. Now, he didn't go around tearing down their idols. He didn't commit acts of violence, okay? That's not what he did. He was motivated to go, though, to the place where all the philosophers and religious people collected and got up and said, I got a better message to you than this. He went and spoke the truth. He went and spoke the truth. When we don't have, or we are complacent about idolatry, we have to be very careful. Because we can actually not be bothered by it. This is not politically correct, and I'm not saying this like I'm judging somebody to, you know, the lake of fire. I'm just saying we have to look at sin in our lives. We have to look at sin in the world. The worship of Mary and the statues of Mary and the saints is idolatry. It is. Just study what they do. Remember, we did a program on it, and I think I even mentioned it here in a sermon, where Archbishop Sheen, he died. They want to make him a saint. But the Catholic Church can't make him a saint. And the reason why is there's two dioceses. There's two dioceses that are fighting over his body. Now, you know why, don't you? If you have his body, there's magic in the body. And what they will do is cut him up in little pieces and send him around to different Catholic churches, because under every altar in a Catholic church is a box. And the more pieces of saints you have in there, the more God will interact, because the more those saints, because if you have his finger, when she gets to canonize, he's already in heaven. But if you get his finger and he's made a saint and you pray with the finger there, he'll go to God for you. He'll intercede for you because you've got his finger. That's modern Catholicism. And I'm not making that up. Just go type in relics, Catholic relics, and see what the Catholic Church says. I mean, their own teaching. It is pure idolatry. It is magic. It is superstition. It is against God. It's that simple. You can go to Catholic churches. There's one in one of the cities in Rome where there's the head of one of the women in a box. And you pay money and the light comes on and you look at her shriveled up head. Now, if you go to Rome, her body's there. Because both wanted it, and they couldn't figure out what to do, so you get the head and we get the body. This way, she will pray for all of us. It's idolatry at its purest form. It is absolute idolatry at its purest form. They say, wow, you're upset over that. Yes, I am. Do I hate Catholics? No. Any more than Paul hated the pagans he was with. He ate with them, right? He preached to them. But if that doesn't stir us, what is wrong with us? Have we become complacent to idolatry? Have we become complacent to idolatry? Now, another way we can actually commit idolatry and not realize it is that we mix paganism with the worship of God. Now, you know, I mean, this gets down to where people say, okay, pagans sang songs, so we shouldn't sing songs. I mean, there are certain Christian denominations that won't even let a piano in the church because, well, pagans had pianos and we shouldn't have pianos. The issue of the second commandment is, it's what you bow down to, okay? What you bow down to. Paul dealt with this in the Corinthian church in great depth, because the Corinthians were mainly Gentiles who come into the church. They were in the center of the Greek world, right in the middle of Greece. And they were about as superstitious a people as you can imagine. And they had mixed all kinds of pagan, idolatrous practices into the church. So let's go to 1 Corinthians 10, because this is a concept that actually you find in the Old Testament. But he says it so well here. I'm going to use the New Testament reference. You actually find this in the Old Testament, but not, he's just so dramatic in the way he says it. He's talking to these people who are mixing paganism in with their worship of God. And he's talking about the Passover service. You know, there's another place here where he even talks about in this book or this letter, how, remember when Christ sat down that night with his disciples, he took the bread, he took the wine. So he keeps taking them back to that Passover service. And verse 14, he says, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. Now, why would he be telling them that? Because they weren't. They weren't fleeing idolatry in the church. I speak to you as wise men. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? For we, though many, are one bread and one body. We are all partake of that one bread. Now, his argument is, this, because it's a really important argument to where he's going to go, is that when you take the bread and wine, it symbolizes the blood and body of Christ shed for us. Is that not communion with Christ? Are you not in a relationship with him? Because he's resurrected. So the participation in this ceremony isn't just a ritual. Participation in this ceremony is a relationship between you and Christ. Okay, first point. Then he goes on, verse 18. Observe Israel after the flesh. Are not those who eat of the sacrifices partakers of the altar? In other words, the sacrifices, look at ancient Israel. And the priests took these sacrifices and offered them to God. And certain of the sacrifices, the priests would then sit and eat. He says, because why? It was part of, that sacrifice was part of their relationship with God. And they actually received a blessing from God for doing it. So he's saying the rituals, whether it be the New Testament rituals of bread and wine, or the Old Testament rituals of actually doing a sacrifice, were part of a personal relationship between the people and God. Then he goes on, he says, what am I saying then? Well, that's a good question. What's the point you're making here, Paul? Now remember, we started at the beginning of the thought. What is the thought he's dealing with? Idolatry. Right? That's the thought. He says, what am I saying then? That an idol is anything? Or what is offered to idol is anything? He says, oh, come on. He could have said, remember what David said? They don't stink, they don't speak, they don't, you know, they're nothing. Remember what Isaiah said? Remember what Jeremiah, he could have quoted all kinds of Old Testament passages. He didn't need to, he made his point. The idol itself is wood and stone and maybe some gold overlaid. Okay, that's all it is. But he says, rather, that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and of the table of demons. This is real important. Underneath all this useless idolatry is a power. There is a power to it. People who participate in it receive a power from it. But that power is not of God. When Paul says that Satan is the god of this world, he meant exactly that. He's the god of this world. And the religions that we see in this world are not worshiping God. They're worshiping Satan. They don't know it. But underneath is a demonic power. You know, when my son was in college, he took a comparative religion class. And he said, Dad, my assignment is I have to go to a Hindu temple. He said, would you go with me? Because I'm not going to go by myself. I said, okay. I said, actually, I've always wanted to see a Hindu ceremony, worship ceremony. So we went in one night where they were having a ceremony. We went in and walked around before anybody was there and looked at all the idols, you know, the elephant god and the one of the goddesses that has, I don't know, 6 or 8 armors. Yeah. And we looked at all of them. And we said, well, we would like to talk to one of the priests, because the priests were walking around in all these gowns and everything. And someone said, oh, if you want to learn about Hinduism, now this is one of the parishioners, okay, don't talk to the priest. They don't really know anything. You have to talk to a philosopher. Okay? So there's this old guy. I mean, he looked like 100 years old. And he's sitting in a chair over on the wall, asleep. They went and woke him up and said, there's somebody here to talk to you. So he took it to the side room, and he explained to us Hinduism. I said, Chris, this is great. When are you ever going to get somebody that's a bona fide philosopher? You know, he wrote a book, he'd done all these things, and he's going to teach you about Hinduism. So he taught him that the purpose of Hinduism is to discover the God that is within you. So you have to find the God that's in you. He said, now, 3 of the greatest Hindus that ever lived was Buddha, which is interesting because he's not a Hindu. Jesus is not Hindu, and Mother Teresa was not Hindu. He said, because all 3 of them discovered the God that was in them. When Jesus said, I am God, he discovered that God was, there's a God within him. So, he explained all this, and my son's trying to write it down, and it's like, you know, he, of course, this is such craziness, and he's writing it down to him. Well, I mean, it is craziness, but he's writing it all down. And finally he said, well, what do you do for a living? I said, I'm a Christian pastor. Well, the interview was shut down immediately. Although he was so old and decrepit, I did help him back out to his chair. I thought he was going to fall down. He was trying to get away from me so quick. And I thought, okay, come on, I'll get you back to your chair. So I got him back to the chair. I couldn't help it. I should. I just told him. So we set him down. And now they're having the ceremony. So we watched them perform all these sacrifices. Now, all the people came in, and they were very dressed up. Of course, most of them had clothing from India. It wasn't the Western-style clothing. And they sat around on the floor, and some of them were eating, and the children were playing, and they were talking. It was incredibly festive. There was a power there. There was joy in the room. As we watched, as they walked up to each god and goddess, of course, their sacrifices aren't animal sacrifices because they believe in the sacredness of all life. So, you know, there's a goddess, and they all walk up, and the priest, they throw flowers and vegetables there in front of the goddess. And then they take jugs of milk and orange juice and pour all over, you know. I guess it was orange juice, that's what it looked like. It was some kind of juice and milk and poured all over this goddess and threw vegetables on her, and they went from you know, statue to statue. And I'm just watching this. My son keeps pulling up. You know, he's just a grown man. He's in college. And he keeps pulling up. I'm watching. Finally, he's just pulling up. Okay, so we walk outside. They're doing some kind of candlelight ceremony. And I look at all that. We got in the car. And he said, Dad, there's demons in that place. Yeah. We got to get out of here. I said, there's a power there, is there? He said, yeah. I said, yeah. That's what you're feeling. There's a power there. There is a power in idolatry. And that's why we have to be so careful. Now, we can't be, we can be careful to the point of absurdity. You know, oh, I'm sorry. I can't bring an instrument in because some pagan religions use instruments. Well, come on. David used instruments, okay? So, we could use instruments. But, think about the obvious things. Christmas. Easter. What are they? You take some Christianity, and you take some idolatry, and you mix them together. There's a real danger in that. And we can become complacent to that. The secretizing is the word that's used. It means the mixing of religions. And then my last point here is that, and this is really a whole other subject, okay? I'm just leading up to this, and this is a whole other subject. And that is, idolatry can be anything that we make more important than God. See, if you think about it, it's about worship. It's about who do I bow down to or what do I bow down to? You know, the greatest danger you and I have is we're not going to rush off and join, you know, start worshiping Hindu gods. And you and I are not going to give our children bunnies and Easter eggs. Right? But do we worship at the feet of materialism? Do we worship at the feet of money? Do we worship at the feet of fame? Do we worship at the feet of, I could have had a better house than my neighbor? Or a bigger car? What do we worship at? What do we bow down to? Do you worship at the feet of your work? So you sacrifice God and your family and all kinds of other things just to do your job because you like your job? What are we sacrificing our lives for? Now we're into the spiritual application of idolatry. The spiritual application of idolatry. Remember what Jesus said? Oh, let's go there. I wasn't going to go there, but Matthew 6. Matthew 6, verse 19. Because here he hits at, really, the concept of what do you bow down to. And so this is a New Testament application of idolatry. It's part of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 6, verse 19. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. Now, he's not saying, well, let your property go into decay. Don't take care of anything. Live like a bum. That's what he's saying. He says, your treasures. And he goes on to explain that. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. What is it we serve? He goes on, he says, for the lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Verse 24 now, he just brings it down. He's talking. He says, now let me make this, bring this down to the central point of what I'm making. No man can serve. You can put worship in there. No man can bow down to two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, or God and money. But let's just fill out anything you could put in there. Husband, wife, children. People actually could worship their husband or their wife. Or their children, to where they will please them instead of God, which is, by the way, a real good way to destroy your relationship with your husband or your wife or your children. But you say, oh, no, I'll please them instead of God. That's a form of idolatry. Who do you serve? Now we're really into the spirit of the law. Whom do we serve? And you and I aren't in much danger of worshiping Athena, you know, or any of the old Canaanite gods and goddesses, or Horus of the ancient Egypt. We are in danger sometimes of worshiping the false values of our society to where we serve them instead of serving God. Whom do you serve? That is the great question of the second commandment. You can bring the second. Remember I said the first commandment comes down to, are you loyal to God? The second commandment comes down to, whom do you serve? Whom do you bow down to? There is one last point here, and that is back in Exodus 20. Let's go back there. I said that was my last point. Oh, no. When I get to the thou shalt not bear false witness, I'll have to repent. Exodus 1. I forgot. There is one last point here. I looked down at my notes and I do have a last point. That's one way to keep people going, though. And my last point is, you do that 5 or 6 times. And my last point is, remember I said in verse 5, I forgot about this. I ended in the middle of the verse. So So let's look at the rest of the verse. For I am the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, and showing mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. And you think, well, that's an odd place to throw this statement in. You know, but what is he really saying? He said, for those who don't worship me, their sins will be passed on to their children, and they will commit the same sins because they'll teach them, and then they'll pass them on, and they'll pass them on. You know, four generations later, they'll still be doing the same things, and they'll be reaping the same consequences. He says, but you worship me in the way that I wish to be worshipped. He said, 1,000 generations later, you'll find some benefit. There's a generational effect on obeying God. Now, that generational effect may end up in generations long after you're dead. You know, you may not see it in immediate generations, but there's a generational effect on our relationship with God. And so, he throws it, you know, you say, well, that's an odd place to make this statement. It seems to have nothing to do with this commandment. Actually, it has everything to do with the first two commandments. I am the Lord your God. I'm all there is. Worship me in the way that I want to be worshipped. And if you do, I will bless you and I will be in your life and it'll go on. It'll be passed on. Don't. And you just make the same mistakes over and over and over again. Really, it gets pretty simple, doesn't it? We really break all this down. It gets very simple. The second commandment is about, what do you bow down to? Who do you worship? What do you worship? And who establishes the priorities in your life? You and I have been called to remove all idols from our lives. In the obvious sense of any false representations of God. That's why you'll see we'll put up no crucifixes. We're not going to have pictures of God. We're not going to have, picture of the Sistine Chapel here. I mean, the painting, although it is an amazing painting. You know, we're not going to show that or have that as part of our worship service or even say that does not visualize God for us. Secondly, we have been called to get rid of the false gods and not mix idolatry into our worship. Because I've talked to so many people said, so what? We know Easter isn't really Christmas, or isn't Christian. We know that. But it's good. Not if you read the second commandment. It's not good. And then also, it is that we need to reject the idolatry of materialism and fame and pleasure. Pleasure is an idol in our world. Fun, fun, fun. It's an idol. Pleasure at all costs. We are to reject those idols. Because you and I have been called, and now this really expands out. I'm like ending it where you should begin. We have been called to worship God in spirit and truth.